listening to Castrol CarCast on Podcast One.
First, I'll hit betonline.ag. I'll buy you guys a little time. NFL and college football plus World Series. You can visit betonline.ag, take advantage of the best bonuses in the business. Use the promo code PODCAST1 for a 50% sign-up bonus. Matchups, Week 9, San Fran at Arizona, the unbeaten Niners. Yeah. Wow. Minnesota at KC, that should be a good game. Detroit at Oakland and many others. Also, we've got $500 in rewards to give out each week to five listeners, and you can add a $5,000 season-long charity contest. Join the conversation at Twitter at hashtag Sportsnet Challenge. And let's see, San Fran at Arizona, that'll be my lock. I'll take San Fran, 34-14. Use the promo code PODCAST1. Receive a 50% sign-up bonus today. BetOnline.ag, your online sportsbook experts.
Air. Fuel. Spark. The trinity of power. You need all three to bring your engine to life. Kenny and Norm knew that, which is why for over 50 years, the company that bears their name has been re-engineering what filtration can do. Engineered to protect against dirt and scientifically proven to provide up to 50% more airflow. K&N, 50 years of performance and innovation.
Yeah, get it on, got to get it on, no choice but to get on, man, they get on, and welcome to the CarCast SEMA edition. I'm Adam Carolla, it's Matt the Motorator, DeAndrea.
Hello.
Over there. Levels okay, Chris Max Pata.
Yeah.
Steve Williams is with us. Richard Bisson is with us as well, both from K&N. We'll talk about that in 1 second. Patrick Dempsey should be in here soon enough. Keanu and Gard Hollinger from Arch, I think, are going to come by. We're going to hit it all. Good to see you, Steve. Good to see you, Richard.
Great to be here, Adam. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Good morning.
Happy 50th anniversary.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate
that. Huge presence here at SEMA this year, and some incredible vehicles in the booths. Adam mentioned Arch Motorcycles, and you got a new partnership with them and a couple of their bikes out front, and this incredible Porsche 935 behind us as well, with a 345, I don't know, 3019 tire on it. It's
there's a crazy twin turboed Porsche. Looks a little like my 935,
yeah,
but a little more extreme in its own weird way. Steve is the K&N chief engineer officer, and he's also engineering officer, I'd say, also drag racer. And Richard, you're the CEO. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm all the right. New CEO. I've been here since June, and I'm really excited about K&N and our 50th year anniversary, and then moving on for the next 50.
Steve, you do what kind of racing?
Actually, I race with the NHRA. I've done it for about 25 or 30 years, and we race dragsters, and then I have a 63 Corvette racing Super Gas and Super Comp. So the dragster's it'll run about 200, 210,
okay.
And we run in a class that runs 890, but it's about a 650 car in a quarter mile. So and last year we won the championship, so I'm celebrating not only a world championship with NHRA, but I've been with the company for 24 years and watched it grow through the years, and it's always been vested in racing. It's such a big part of the DNA of what K&N is. Kenny and Norm were motorcycle racers.
Is that the K in it?
That is it. Yep.
Wow.
Yep. Kenny and Norm.
So simple. And they started out of what? Where did K&N begin?
You know, K&N actually started in Riverside, California, and Kenny and Norm, believe it or not, had a motorcycle where they sold motorcycles, and Malcolm Smith, who's a pretty famous desert racer. I mean, he's like a legend, you know,
on any Sunday, sure.
And, you know,
yeah.
you know, Paul Newman.
He would do trials. He would do desert stuff. He'd go out with Steve McQueen and just crush it. Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of us were
probably
local.
Probably flat track, too, even. Or maybe not flat track. I don't know.
He did race flat track.
And then flat track.
And both Kenny and Norm were flat track racers. Well, in those days, you know, they used to race Jawas, you know, the old Triumphs. You know, of course, Harley-Davidson, about anything you could, you know, hang your leg over, they would race at local fairgrounds. Well, they had little paper filters, and the tracks would get too muddy. They'd cave in, and then the dirt go in the motor, and then that would seize and be over with. So Kenny and Norm actually invented the very first washable, reusable K&N for Kenny and Norm for motorcycle racing. So the whole company's heritage is right there in Riverside, California. Started there, still there today. We have 850 employees.
Wow.
And got involved in auto racing. It was all a natural motocross racing. I mean, you know, the business really, though, grew up out of motorcycle racing.
It did. It's interesting how the brand has grown so much. It's just a combination of I don't know, just a simple enough product. It's the first mod everybody does. It's just you can get it everywhere. So I guess distribution is part of the model as well. But you know, it just seems like, certainly when I was growing up with cars starting at, you know, 16, 15, 16, you know, that's the first thing you grab is the K&N filter.
Yeah.
You know, it's an amazing brand
that
you guys built over
the years. Well, it's the easiest horsepower to put on your car, I mean, or bike or whatever. I mean, you know, when you start getting into exhaust and cams and start opening up the bottom end of the engine and all that kind of stuff. The first thing you do for the power is K&N just because it works.
Yeah.
It's easier and you can add some. How much of the business now, I'm guessing a lot of it is like cartridge replacement, if I'm not using that term correctly, but opening up the box in a standard F-150 and dropping in a K&N element.
Yeah,
yeah,
versus
an
intake kit.
Yeah,
sorts.
I mean, the business has different product families. It's obviously grown through the years. But, I mean, we are, you know, one of the number one selling performance oil filters. And it's all about, you know, being able to filter the oil with less restriction. But then there's the replacement air filter we're known for. We're the only reusable product. So it's not only does it breathe more air, of course, in our, you know, has less pressure drop. But then if you want to get deeper into the car, then, of course, replacing the whole intake system with a brand new tube that's designed to increase the power and the throttle body. So that complete intake track, we sell those. We just started the last few years selling exhaust systems because obviously if you get good at airflow, not just the air flowing into the engine, but going out of the engine. So we do a lot of OEM private label exhaust. So the business really has grown into a true performance, and it kind of goes with the consumer, whether you just want the easy modification or you want to do something a little more technical.
And
don't want to just be good at inhaling. You want to be able to time your exhale.
Right.
I've tried.
Kind of.
Because I thought, like, what's the best part of breathing?
Yeah.
And I went, inhale.
Inhaling.
Like, you know, when you're underwater and you come up from the deep end, that's the best part. And one night I tried. I said, you know what, I'm just going to inhale for a while and see if it's that much better. I passed out after like 9 minutes. My kids found me. I was in the shower. It wasn't pretty.
It's not pretty. That's
all right. Note to self. Exhale. You got to have the combination
of
stuff.
You got to come in through the K&N. You got to leave through the exhaust.
Yeah.
Now.
It's like you were saying, the quickest way to add a couple of horsepower is the filter swap. But I think we kind of forget that the intake, it creates noise as well. And one way to tailor noise is not just the exhaust. It's on the intake side as well. You run air filters on one of your race cars and then take them off, and you will notice the difference significantly.
Yeah, it's always interesting to me, whenever one thinks about decibels, they always think about the exhaust and are you running glass packs or cat packs or whatever you're running. Are you running open, whatever, but they don't realize the intake makes a ton of noise. Like if you're just running, you know, I got a couple of cars with triple Webers, a couple of Z cars and things like that. When you run open stacks, it is noisy as
it's got
as
a
hell.
Real drone to it. A while. Remember the old Dodges? I mean, the old 440s.
I mean,
you could really hear that intake sound. And it's actually the second attribute. Consumers, the number one attribute is obviously the performance or the throttle response.
Yeah.
But the second attribute is the sound. It makes the car sound like it has more performance. It increases that sound.
In drag racing, you run filters on all of your drag race cars. And what I mean is does everybody in racing run filters, or do you just run filters?
It really does. No, there are a lot more air filters in racing than most people realize. And, in fact, in our booth here, we actually have an air filter from the car that won the Indy 500 because we make filters for those cars. Obviously, short tracks, modified dirt tracks, there's sprint car filters. If you go around the booth, you see that almost every form of racing requires that protection level. Now, obviously, it has less restriction, on a drag car. It's a very specific type of motor. We're the official air filter of NASCAR. There are more Canon air filters in NASCAR than there are any other filter because of that lower pressure drop. So, I used to live by Riverside Raceway before they closed it.
Yeah.
So there were actually Canon filters at Riverside Raceway back in the 70s.
So. Is Indy run, so at the 500, all those cars are running filters. Now, obviously, they have a lot of money for engines, and they're worried a little more about winning than they are about wear and tear, probably. How does that factor in? Like, what is the thinking behind that? If they go open, scared something's going to get sucked in?
A great question. The actual filter, because they do post-race inspection, when they opened up the air box into the fuel injection box, there's a hot dog wrapper on the outside of the filter on the car that won.
Really?
Now, what would have happened if that paper filter would have gone down inside the engine?
Man, I got
hard to say. Could it maybe hold the intake valve
if
open?
If my driver was eating a hot dog during a race, let me finish.
Too close to the pace.
I'm sorry. I know it's a long race, and I know you can get peckish out on the road. But
how do they get it? Is it in the water tube? And there's a separate hot dog
it's
tube?
It's inside that because in the inlet. But what the real reason they run it is if you notice, they call it the marbles.
Right.
The
marbles.
Groove,
yes.
Well,
no, you're right.
That tire flips all those little pieces of rubber up. This filter's designed to keep that out.
I do a 25, maybe a 30 minute race at Laguna Seca in a 935, and you go to the front of the car after the race, and there's just marbles stuck all over the front of it.
And it's in every nook and cranny of that car. Yeah. It's pretty much
in drag racing. You're usually behind someone that's on the starting line.
Yeah,
and so it's really, and believe it or not, when they leave the line, the tires don't. It doesn't dead stick. It does have wheel speed.
Yeah,
and if you're behind it, it'll shoot up rocks, things that are on the track. It'll come into your car in through the intake. So it's really about just keeping that stuff out of the engine. Yeah, crazy.
Richard, I feel like you're getting short shrift over here. You're the new CEO.
Yeah.
Which you must have been doing something before this that had something to do with the automotive world, the performance world. Why are you here? Why do you deserve to be here? Why should we listen to you?
So I'm actually the consumer product guy, right? Mm-hmm. So right here, Steve is the DNA of our company. He's the racing guy. But what he didn't tell you about is we also make filtration products for the home and industry.
Really?
Right. And so, I mean, what we do at the end of the day is we're experts at filtration. Okay. Mm. And so I'm here as the consumer products guy. You know of a company called Waterpik?
Yeah.
So I was there for about 12 years. We took Waterpik from, pretty much down and out to kicking ass against Oral-B and Sonicare.
Yeah.
I was looking at this guy's teeth when we met, and I was like, something in the dental hygiene.
Are you water flossing?
I do have a Waterpik. My dentist told me to get a Waterpik.
That's right.
And it's awesome. It's good. The irony is I really use it only when I go to see the dentist. I do that move.
You know, the hygienist knows you are not fooling her.
Yes, she knows.
I don't know why, though, because every time I go in, they go, are you flossing? And I say, you tell me.
Yeah.
You're getting paid.
If you cut it with a little bullet rye, there's a little hopper. If you're going to do night water picking like I do, and you just put just a couple of fingers of bullet rye, and then the rest tap water. I'm not a weirdo. It's a nice feeling.
And then your son comes in and finds you with that pig rolling off your face.
God, I forgot to exhale again. Do you guys do filters for, like, HVAC systems, water systems?
Yeah, Steve actually developed a product for home air filtration. Why don't you tell him about it?
Oh, really? Yeah. Now, I'm really intrigued. Because I can't stand pulling that thing out full of cat hair and dust bunnies and all that.
You know, I'm kind of a do-it-yourself guy, and of course, you know, I came from the home building industry before I came to K&N 24 years ago. And so when I would go to Home Depot or Lowe's, I kept seeing trucks with decals and K&N decals. And of course, you know, nobody likes, you know, to replace that filter, and you forget what size it is. And it's usually cheap and disposable. And then I thought, you know what? Why couldn't K&N do the same thing? I mean, we're trying to change the way people think about air filters, from something cheap and disposable and paper to something of really high quality. And so, you know, last year, you know, we finally found the material to make a really good home air filtration. So now you just take it out in the backyard, put some 409 on it, wash it out, put it right back inside. And so we really feel like the company's got a heritage in taking something that was cheap and inefficient and disposable and selling a consumer something that's a really higher quality product.
So it's a washable.
So it's our first consumer.
A washable home filter. You don't oil it like you do the car filter.
No, it doesn't have a tackifier. It's built into the material.
And how do you offer a million-mile warranty like on your other filters?
Well, it's a long-life filter. Yeah. It's a lifetime
about
filter.
About 15
for your
years,
home.
As long as your home air conditioning unit is operating, right?
How many and how many sizes does that come in? Because I'm going through my own air conditioning system in my mind's eye, and I'm thinking of all the different sizes for all the different. Is there? Can you make your own size?
There's about 22 of the most popular sizes, but obviously they go up into like 60 different sizes. Right now we offer about 80% of the sizes, and we keep releasing more.
Where does one
universal filter?
Where does one find that?
Right now, you can get it right off of knnfilters.com. We sell it direct to consumers, and it's available through Amazon.
Wow.
So Amazon's been selling a lot of filters.
Yeah, so today it's Amazon. In the future, we're going to go, how about DIY brick and mortar, right? And then there's, you know, service folks, right, in a multi-step, approach. And so in the future, that's the kind of stuff that will happen. But think about it. This air filter is eliminating those pollutants that are coming in your house, making your air conditioning unit operate better, and then saving the consumer quite a bit of money instead of, you know, throwing away those disposable filters, and then lessening our landfills if that's important to anybody.
It is. Not anyone here, but there are folks back in L.A. who pretend to care. They're just trying to get laid. Let's be honest. Let's be honest here, gentlemen. To me, the saddest thing ever is the old air filter, the cardboard one with the hair and the stuff in it. Whenever I change it, I'm like, but that's all the air's been passing through. I'm going. I got the water pick. I got the filters on the car. Now I'm getting the home filter. I had no idea.
Yeah.
And then in the future, there's data centers we should be protecting, right? You know, the more and more data centers in the world.
Right.
You want them to operate smoothly and things of that sort. So
scrubbing the air. Wow.
That's what the suit's here for.
Yeah.
All right.
Good job, Richard.
I think Dempsey's out there walking around somewhere. I mean, not that you guys are, you know, B-list celebrities, but we got an A-lister wandering around.
We certainly do.
Out there.
I'm a C-lister. Don't get me wrong. I'm not judging. I was told we're going to be presented a gift before they leave. I don't know if we're getting a gift or they're getting a gift.
I don't really know, but we're going to. Here comes, you go.
I brought along some friends from NHRA.
You. Wow.
And last year I won the world championship and asked the president to come in. And his name is Glenn Cromwell, president of NHRA. And he made you and Patrick both lifetime memberships of the NHRA. So you look at the date there, how far it goes out.
Wow. It goes out.
I love that everybody in motorsports give gives booze for a gift. Like, if someone's driving,
here's your license. It's drag responsibly. You know, right?
You got a license and a bottle of
it
wine.
It says
so there's a boss sit down.
It says it expires 12/31/2099 or until your chute doesn't open.
It's a weird thing to put on the car, but sure.
I know. I don't know why they'd have to put that ominous warning on the car. And how do they know? Maybe it'll always work. Well, rules are rules. All right, Patrick Dempsey has just joined us, by the way. Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it.
Very much so. And we want to let you know that we took it one step further, and we are inviting you and Patrick to teach you to race in a dragster at the Winter Nationals. We have the cars. NHRA is going to let us use the racetrack before the Winter Nationals. I'm going to license one of you, and then a friend of mine, Tom Bear, we have both dragsters. And then once we get you licensed, they've invited you guys to grudge race at next year's Winter Nationals.
Hold on.
On Saturday.
I do grudge sex. I don't do grudge racing. I enjoy my racing. So if it takes a turn for the sexual, that will be an element. But if we're just racing, it'll be for the luck.
My reaction time's off already.
So the challenge is officially set.
What are we driving? We're driving a dragster.
I've got two dragsters now. Both these cars run well over 200 miles an hour. So what I'd like to do, though, is get you guys out there on Wednesday, take you through what a normal driver would go through, a little bit of class time, and then get out there, go 60 feet, 330, 660, and then teach you guys how to drive. And I'm talking about a real license.
I'd love to do it.
So you'll be an NHRA licensed driver.
That's funny. I was walking in here, and we passed Hemi Under Glass. And last time I saw that car, Jay Leno was rolling in it.
Was that what he was rolling in when he came around the corner?
He was rolling in Hemi Under Glass, which, again, another ominous warning to not get in the car. I'll do it. I love that stuff.
I'm into it. I'll try it.
We'll try it, and
something
then we'll have grudge.
Have you done any
grudge
drag
match? No, I've never done the quarter mile. I've never done any straight ahead anything. So
really?
only
I was
road
here
course
in
stuff.
Las Vegas last weekend on the drag strip driving the new Shelby GT500s. And by the way, great car. Round and round and round, just going lap after lap, and before that, the Dodge Challenger Hellcats doing some track racing at.
What do you think will turn at the end of the weekend in that dragster?
Yeah, what would be considered a good, not a lap
a good
time, but a good time
would be probably in the 750 at about 195 to 200.
It's incredibly fast.
Yeah,
and
it's
obviously we want to because both of you guys are accomplished drivers. You know how to drive, but. What I'd like to do is, I mean, it'll go 60 feet in sub, it'll go 0 to 100 in less than a second.
Wow. That's
so, I
quick.
Mean, it is, it's a, it's, that first sensation is pretty amazing.
I don't want to have eye contact since I had that. I don't want to. You know why? You're not even looking at me.
You know why? I brought up the sexual thing, and now I can't get the phrase some go, some blow out of my head. That's all I got in my head right now. Some go, some blow, but now it means something.
It's a whole different thing now.
It means something else.
Yeah.
All right.
I just want to extend it to you.
Thank you, Steve. I'm in. I'm in.
You guys
Patrick,
heard it.
I'm looking forward to it.
I'm going to work on the dates. All right.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Sean.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
Hey guys, let me tell you about K&N filters, the world's best air filter for over 50 years. You can improve vehicle performance, protect critical systems, breathe cleaner air. Visit knfilters.com to shop their industry-leading performance products. They have air filters, cold air intakes, tuning and cleaning products, and more. That's knfilters.com, and they have free shipping on orders over $25. Just go to knfilters.com.
And now we got Patrick Dempsey in here.
Am I done? That's it?
No. Good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you, too.
What's going on in your motor world? Oops, don't worry about that.
I had a nice experience yesterday with 01 out in the desert running around with the
What were you
Jim
driving?
Jordan, which was just a little Razor, which was a lot of fun. I mean, bang for your buck, great experience.
Yeah, like buggy kind of
it's
stuff.
It's like a little
the Polaris, UTVs, right? Yeah. Like UTVs. Yeah,
but the suspension, tires, everything, just a blast.
Man, we were talking to
and desert racing so much
to,
fun. Anyway.
PJ Jones, Parnelli Jones' right, son, and he's really into the UTV racing, and his son races, and at this point he's developing parts for it. And he's like, when you really get into the racing of these things, it's not cheaper.
Oh, no. I mean, the more you get into it, the more you're going to spend. But I'll tell you, the racers are really quick.
Oh, yeah.
I had a great opportunity to run the Mint. Mm-hmm. And we at the very beginning, you're trying to chase down these little racers, and they get through the technical stuff so fast. Mm-hmm. You get them on the long runs. But, man, they're so much fun.
They look incredible.
And it's just great racing. Yeah.
What's the Le Mans plan this year?
The season started. The new season started. So we got the young drivers in there. Our thing is really developing the young drivers and moving them up. That's what we're really about.
Are you continuing to race yourself, or are you trying to getting more into team owner, team?
Yeah, it's really hard not to be behind the wheel. It's great. Yeah. I mean, Le Mans, I've done that. I've had a great experience there. But I'd love to do some sprint racing.
Yeah.
If I was going to do one more race, I think Vegas Arena would be a fun race. It was funny. I turned on the TV, just finished remodeling the house, and turned the TV on for the first time, and boom, up pops the telecast. I'm like, okay, maybe that's a sign.
It's a sign. Have you seen Ford v Ferrari yet?
I've not seen it. Have you seen it?
Yes,
is it any good?
I have.
How
yes.
is it?
It's very good. Yes.
And you knew Shelby, right? Did you
I didn't know.
Any time
no,
with him?
I didn't know Shelby. We know the Pete Brocks and all the folks in his world and his orbit and all those guys from back then. And we interviewed all those guys for the 24-Hour War and other movies we've done. But I met Shelby once at the Peterson, you know, a million years ago.
I did a rally from the Peterson here for his, like, 84th birthday. And then he lived in my neighborhood, so I would go up and see him, and he was always cooking. It was really funny. Like, blueberry pie was his thing.
Oh, really? It seems like I would have said barbecue as well.
He'd sit in his living room in the Lazy Boy, and then he'd tell you his racing stories. It's great. So I hope the movie does well. I mean, it'd be nice to see a racing movie do well. There's other stories to be told.
Yeah. It's
Dan Gurney, I'd like to see that story. I think that's an important one. Certainly as a documentary.
It's a good movie. One of the guys that's portrayed in the movie is Phil Remington.
Right.
Who ended up then with Gurney and American Eagle Racing and all that kind of stuff. And when I went and interviewed Gurney probably about a year, 2 years before he died, I don't know. I went out to a shop and
I think it was the last on-camera interview Gurney.
No, I went out to like Orange County where he was making parts for SpaceX. And he showed me Phil Remington's like workstation. He's like, that's Phil's workstation. Phil had died a year earlier, and it's like, that's it. And, you know, the thing that struck me about the movie, fresh on my mind, because we just interviewed Christian. They brought me out to watch it at Fox or whatever a month ago, and then I interviewed Matt Damon and Christian Bale about it. James
Are they in the
Mangle.
Cars? Are they racers, do you think?
They're not really.
No.
No, okay.
I don't think so. But I don't know so. But
they're good actors.
No,
they can pretend
like
to be in their cars.
They're racing. But, you know, the only fake part of the movie... I must say, because you've never done this. I don't think I've never done this. I've done enough racing. There's that part where the one guy pulls up next to the other guy on the Mulsanne straight, and then they look at each other, and they give real mean looks for a real long time, and then they look straight again, and then they look at each other, and they scowl, and it's like... I think when people race, they just tend to look forward.
Yeah, they're not going to be...
tend to race.
It's their time for dirty looks.
But it's a movie. They have to play it up, but...
I'm just surprised they got the movie made.
Oh, my
that
God.
That itself is a miracle.
It took a long time because
I know Michael Mann had a project he wanted to get made for
there was
a while.
That. Yeah. There was Go Like Hell. Yeah. There was a book that kept getting optioned by A.J. Baim and all that kind of stuff. But what the hell is that? So the movie's good.
Right.
And I was talking to all those guys about it. And it's a really interesting kind of period piece because it's L.A., Venice, California, like in the 60s. And the real thing about the movie that's interesting
is... the industry out here at that time was major. Everybody was here.
Could you imagine going to Venice and just making cars now? Like, no regulations, no EPA, no permits, no city, bunch of 19-year-old like hot rodders welding and building the cars for you. Can you imagine just in all places, Venice, California, just like going, I'm going to hang my shingle up, start making cars... And the city'd be like, yeah, knock yourself out. Go ahead.
Well, the funny thing is with the Cobra, they only had like one body, right? And they kept painting it for every journalist.
Yeah.
That's a remarkable
the
story.
The car companies still do that. I drove a Lexus LFA. I drove like a yellow one. I was like, oh, what happened to the white one? They're like, it's the same car.
Right.
We just painted it. We're just figuring it out, bringing it out to a new show.
They learned
show.
From Shelby, yeah. Which he, you know.
When you started getting into racing, you know, I moved out to California long ago, and I spotted at the corner of my eye a car you don't normally see. I saw a Panos. Probably a Panos Esperante.
What color was it?
And I roll up, and you're driving.
Oh,
it.
Yeah, you know? Sure.
And it seemed, I don't want to date it, but it seemed like a while ago. Maybe God, yeah, 20 years
because
ago.
Because that's how I got started. I went down to do an event, a kids' charity event in Atlanta, in Braselton, where I met Don and Dan Panos, and I walked around the factory, and then... I was
they
like,
own
this is
a
cool.
Track down there too.
Yeah, well, yeah, they Don Panos owned, you know, several tracks. He owned Sebring, Mosport. Yeah.
Oh, really?
And Road Atlanta. And they had their racing program, and I went through that right after. I had won, I think it was an auction to raise money, like the three-day racing school.
Yeah.
And that's how I got started. I mean, I had done a Skip Barber before, but then I got into the Panos school, and then I ended up buying a car
from
him, and then I sold it, and but it was fun.
Panos.
It was so unusual. And
it really is unusual.
It's sort of Shelby-esque, and it's got a Ford power plant.
Yeah, it's all Ford.
Yeah,
right.
It's like a Mustang Cobra at the time, like a 99 or 2000 Mustang Cobra drive train.
Yeah, it was just unusual, and it was, I got to support this guy's trying to make some cars. They actually won Le Mans. They won Le Mans with that car.
Yeah,
they had lot of success. It's interesting. I'm kind of wondering what the future holds in terms of value for cars like that. Because you take cars like what is it, Spyker?
Yeah,
things like that, and you kind of go like, first they came out, then nobody wanted them, and then you could get them cheap. But I think they're
going back.
They're
up.
Going
maybe.
Back.
The numbers
up.
Are so low.
But
I'm not sure how many have been
car
made.
Would be collectible, you know.
Go find the one with the right pedigree, certainly. Yeah, the Le Mans winning car. They had a prototype, and then they had the Esperante, which won in class.
So what?
Who knows? I think it's just in time.
What cars are your drivers driving for your team?
We're doing the Porsches, all Porsche. That's it.
And it's all 911 chassis.
Not, they're not Caymans. Yeah.
They're not Caymans. No.
They're all 911.
The RSR. So we're doing that. So it's the team is in the WEC, which is a World Endurance Championship.
Okay.
Is it a
And I haven't tested the new car, so that's something I'd like to do.
Who were we talking to that was talking about a 911 with a mid-engine, which was like a little bit...
Which is where it is. Where's Mr.
Patrick
Long? Where's he?
Yeah,
we got to bring in Mr. Long.
Like a little bit of a fudge.
He's
to try
the one
to get
driving these cars now.
Trying to get a mid-engine in
but
there.
But yeah, the new cars, are the placement of where the motors is more and more like a mid-engine car. Here he is, Mr. Porsche himself. Patrick Long is here.
The tale of two Patricks,
how are you?
Everybody.
Paging me outside. I was like, what did I do?
We were talking about the.
We're talking about the new Porsche WEC mid-engine, that evolution.
Yes, insane. So basically, moving the engine forward of the rear axle gave so much more space for aerodynamics. So that was the biggest thing when I jumped in that car for the first time. Is all of a sudden I had that prototype level rear downforce, and downforce equals confidence for a driver. Le Mans, as you know, the high speed corners, the Porsche curves, you need that aerodynamics to basically keep your foot down on the gas.
What's the big difference between the cup car and that car now? Do you think, is it just more confidence? The car's not moving around as much? It's just on rails going through the corner because of the downforce?
Yeah, bigger tire, bigger brakes, more aero, lighter weight parts, a lot more horsepower, a lot more money to run the car,
yeah,
as you should talk about as a car owner.
Right.
But yeah, it's still a 911. Both of these cars derive from the GT3 that you can buy straight out of the showroom. But the allowance of rules to bolt more shiny, fast, expensive parts on.
What, I was going to say Patrick Dempsey, what track do you like the best? Someone who's, and both Patricks, like traveling around the country and the world. Let's just keep it in the United States. What do you like?
I think the older tracks. I really like Watkins Glen is fun, VIR. Road Atlanta is really a lot of fun. I'm trying to think.
Road Atlanta is awesome. That's old school.
Mazda Raceway, which is it's no longer Mazda Raceway anymore.
WeatherTech. Yeah.
I mean, those old school tracks, they just went out and they had a bulldozer and they laid them out. And there's something in them, the elevation change, the risk reward factor, especially at VAR, certain tracks. If you make a mistake, you're going to pay the price. So that's it for me. What do you think?
VIR is cool. I mean, that's basically if you had a 100-acre backyard and you told your crew, I need the perfect racetrack to take my 935 out and play. That's basically very
really?
Hard. It's sweeping, rolling hills, curbs, very minimalist aesthetically. It's basically the OG racing country yeah. club. It's a cool place.
And they lost the oak tree, which was really, too. There was a corner up there. But and that, the first winner of that big race, you know who that was? It was Carroll Shelby in a Maserati.
Really?
Birdcage, yeah.
Birdcage.
That's right.
Yeah, people forget.
Cool, I don't think I'd ever race it, but it's a
you
cool
ever
car.
See it, though?
Oh,
it's
oh
scary.
Yeah. It's called a birdcage for a reason.
Right.
I just actually was talking to Bruce Meyer. He sent me a picture of Shelby's, had a big Ferrari that he raced in the 50s, like a big privateer car, like a 4.4 liter, whatever, big displacement for Ferrari. Sort of Testarossa with the big intake on the hood and everything. I don't know who owns that car now, but he drove, Ferrari drove Aston Martin. He drove, and I think that whole thing about the sort of finesse of a lighter car and a more nimble car and a car that handled, I think we all like the kind of finesse of the European vibe versus the sort of just brute, cubic inches, kind of straight line. Stuff. I don't know what the wiring is that makes that. I don't know why I loved Datsun 510s, like a BRE 510 when I was 14 or 18. I wanted that car. I didn't want a CUDA or even a Corvette. Like, I wanted that little nimble thing that felt like it was always winding up and you could throw around. Does that resonate with you guys? Do you have that feeling as well? Is that when you grew up thinking about cars, where is it? So I'm trying to kind of define it. Like, I say to guys all the time, like, they go, you're a car guy, I'm a car guy. And inevitably, they're like, CUDA, Hemi CUDA, they're 440, six-pack, And I'm like, yeah, what about the Dodge? What about a 510? Like, what about a Datsun Roadster? And they're like, I don't know what that is. And I'm like, why?
I'm trying to think. The first, I grew up in rural Maine, so we didn't see a lot of exotic cars, and mostly American muscle. But I do remember one summer I saw a 120 Jag 120,
mm-hmm.
And that the lines on that car blew me away. And that was the first European car I saw in the state of Maine. That was like everybody else had Vets, Smokey and the Bandit. Remember that?
Sure.
Car? That was everybody's dream car as a kid.
Patrick.
Well, not all kids, but I guess.
Other Patrick.
Little Patrick.
Little Patrick. Poor Patrick.
Ginger Patrick.
Ginger Patrick. Yeah. What? I mean, I feel like if you're a Porsche guy, you're a finesse guy versus kind of a brute horsepower guy. Like, you like, I mean, their origins on how much can we get away with as little displacement as possible through being light and nimble and setting the car up and so on and so forth. So I feel like if you're attracted to a Porsche, you are attracted to the sort of finesse cars. Now they have a ton of horsepower and they got big tires and everything else. But
yeah, it's sort of like if you grew up watching American Graffiti and you wanted this blown V8 that twisted the chassis when you revved it up and you just wanted to lay big black lines from the stoplight, then you were more of a Mopar or a GM guy. You were a Detroit Iron guy. But for Porsche family, they're in the mountains of Austria. They're engineers. They're designers. They want to run the back roads in all weather conditions, and they want to smoke the competition. If you think about the late 40s, how big cars were, and all of a sudden they roll into town, and it's like you talked about with the British invasion. It's these light sort of efficient, agile cars, and you take that up into Mulholland, and there's no chance that these big V8s are going to stay with it no matter how much horsepower. And we all know from racing, weight versus horsepower, they're equally as important.
And all the GIs coming back from World War II, too, that brought everybody over. Then you started to see road racing develop after that. That's when all these tracks started, like VIR. These guys had a bulldozer. They'd go out, and they're like, let's do the turn there. We'll go around this way. And the size of those roads in Europe, you want a little car. You don't want a big American muscle car running around there.
I love those stories, too, of the servicemen who were based over in Europe, and they spec'd out a 356, drove it while they were based over there, and then shipped it home with them. I own a 58 356 coupe, and it was a Denmark-based U.S. Military man, and he ordered the car from Wester in Monterey, had it delivered to him in Denmark, drove it there while he was stationed there, and then brought it back to SoCal.
Wow.
How'd you get that information? How'd you track that down?
Dude, Porsche owners, they're like plane spotters. You have the full storyline. I mean, when I bought the car, it had a full
a whole
binder.
Booklet? Yeah.
All the photos, all the owners, I mean, the guys, they had a journal. Every time they changed the oil, they wrote in the journal. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You drove your 912 to Monterey this year, right? That seems
Which
like
is funny because when
a
we
horrible
did the,
idea. That seems like the worst idea I've heard.
When we left the simulator, you pulled over three times on the way out of that place trying to get that car.
How did
I
you
was
get
like
that?
Trying to get the hood closed or something. Matt's like, over there in like, his big, huge SUV. He's like, you all right down there?
Yeah, I was like, what's going down? You're like, it's hot in here. The air doesn't work. And
that is the part I underestimated.
Did you drive the 912 to Monterey?
I did, and I took the long way. So we had an... We had a stop in Ojai for a little dinner, and then I jumped on 33 and took the back roads, which was unbelievable. But what I underestimated is it's still over 100 degrees when you get to Atascadero.
It's hot.
And with no AC, there's not even an airflow switch in that car. I was felt like I was in one of my race cars. It was great training.
Listen, next time, just get the Cayenne Turbo with the trailer and drag your car up there. It'll be a lot easier.
That's not the spirit.
Oh, man. And how many cars did you drive at Monterey? Didn't you drive like five or six this year?
Eight.
Eight?
Yeah. My God, man. You just went from car to car to car.
Yeah.
What was your favorite one in that?
Can I use the word?
Did you feel
driving
dirty?
Whore?
Yeah. I was just, I mean, if you want to drive eight cars, when your run group is coming off, they're pushing your other car up to the grid so you can just get out of your car. You're not going back to the pits, right? Like there's literally another car waiting for you as you climb out of your car, right?
Yeah, the mechanics have it there. It's a separate team. The oil temp's already up, and you don't take your helmet off. You roll into the pit lane. Everybody else goes exit of turn 10. You come around 11 into the pit lane, jump out of one and into the other. And I can't recall the order of the run groups, but there was a time when I was jumping like 1,500 more pounds and 250 more horsepower and going from a sequential six-speed to an H-pattern four-speed. I drove a 59 Speedster that had like 90 horsepower all the way up to a 2001 LMP1 car that had like 750 horsepower. It was a 6.2 liter. So there was and everything in between. And I didn't plan on driving that many cars. And I never wanted to be that guy who's just jogging down the pit lane in his gear, jumping in his next car with his crew waiting. But it was a thing where the phone rang and Bruce Canup was like, hey, you know, Rob can't make this race. So what do you say? You want to drive? Like, hell yeah, that's a bucket list car. Six of the eight cars I had never sat in before, and they were all cars that I've just dreamt of being in. So that, for somebody who's as spoiled as I am driving race cars for a living, is the pinch yourself moments. It's the moments before you were a professional where you're just stoked to experience a car. It's not about making money.
What were they? I mean, we have the two. What were the other six? That's incredible, by the way.
Yeah, so the FW07 was... The one I was most looking forward to, that one was planned. So that's the 83 Monaco winning Formula One car that KK Rosberg drove, a Williams Formula One car.
Wow.
That car, first of all, they start it with an air starter, full crew around you just to get it started. I mean, the whole body has to lift off if you need to prime the car. So just starting the car took like 30 minutes.
What's the livery on that car, just so I can picture it in my head?
The historians in this listening group are going to kill me, but it's white with blue and green. I mean, it's the proverbial early 80s, you know, Williams vibe. So it was before the turbo era. There's still a naturally aspirated Cosworth-powered engine.
Cosworth.
But so from there, the LMP1 we talked about, the Speedster. I drove Bruce Canepa's 962 in one session. That car is the kind of unfair advantage of 962s.
Of
that's Bruce's
you said
creation.
Canepa, so
yeah, this car never. I don't think this car ever raced with that many modern parts on it, but it is the ultimate 962. I mean, the thing felt like it was doing wheelies on the front straightaway. No power steering, so you could only go as fast as you could physically hold on to the car because it will continue to produce downforce the faster you go. And that's when they talk about downforce. Those are the real days.
And you're coming in and out. You're going from a 356 to a Formula One car. How long does it take you to make that adjustment? At what point in your run are you starting to feel comfortable? Because you're the extremes that you're going from one car to the next like that.
No, we're sending it into turn one on
you're
the
going
start.
In.
Yeah, I was
going
with you in the 935 group. I ended up jumping in Chip O'Connor's Chip Connor's Momo
Chip.
935.
Yeah.
And so that was a wild group. I mean, there was all kinds of stuff in that IMSA GT group. And a 935 in itself is a... I'm sure you've talked about it on this podcast, but just it handles really well in a straight line. That's what I say. So you basically just point it and hold on. It's like a shovel with 800 horsepower on the back of
and
it.
And that's a crazy class. Then you jump into a modern LMP car, and it's got all the grip in the world all of a sudden compared to everything else you've been out there. It's it seems like a hectic day.
Do you find I tell me if this sounds like an accurate statement. I only drove vintage cars, and then he got me into a professional Trans Am race a couple years ago, and I got to drive a C7R Corvette.
Yeah, C7R Corvette
in Trans Am 1
with Burton Racing,
and it had 850 horsepower, and I'd never driven the car or anything. But it felt kind of easy because it was like normal.
Oh,
like
it's sequential transmission.
It's sequential and everything worked. And guys had computers and they were setting up the telemetry with the suspension, like in between qualifying and everything. And even though the car was a beast, it was like, hey, this is kind of nice. Like it had a little water thing. I could drink water. It was fun and it was actually, I found it not easy to drive just compared to the sort of craziness of even driving like an old Datsun Roadster or something, like with its stick shifts hitting your leg and it's all weird and you got leaf spring suspension and a live rear axle and stuff like that. Like just having a car set up, just professionally done like for this track, it was relatively easy.
I would say probably the biggest obstacle in doing that is all the vintage races are their small 20-minute sessions, which is good, but they got to get everybody out there. Like you said, you did 8 cars in one day, basically. You were out there for an hour. You had to do like 100 laps, and all of a sudden, you feel, you know, there's no more tire left. It's getting real slick, and it's getting real hot, and the weather's changing in the course of the day. So when you guys do longer races, not just Le Mans, just races throughout the day, anything from World Challenge to IMSA to whatever, it's just, I think, adapting to the car as it, I don't know, sort of how it ages on the track, even though it was 100 laps.
Yeah, I think it's when you do your second stint, you're on old tires, and then you have a full tank, that handling changes dramatically. That's when you can see the drivers really know how to get the most out of that car. You watch the pros, you watch the AMs, and the guys that can really do those second stints well, that's, I think, the big difference. But you're right, I think it's a lot easier in the since the evolution, the technology's improved, but the old school driving, that technique, the heel toe, all of that stuff, and it's a completely different driving experience. Where you're smiling in a way because you're stepping back in time.
I think it has to impact your driving the modern cars. I mean, having that history, like in Rocky IV, when he went to the Soviet Union to train, you know, he's running up a snow hill and he's lifting a log over his head and there's rocks in a barrel and stuff. Like, do you feel like driving those old cars sort of puts you, I don't know, gives you a little edge or at least connects you a little better when you climb into the new car? Like, there's something. The visceral nature of those old cars and what it takes to keep them on the road versus the new cars. Do you feel like that helps driving the modern cars?
For sure. A lot of people ask me, how do I go faster on the racetrack? How do I feel more comfortable in my road car? And we did this as an exercise when we were training for Le Mans. Go put yourself in a controlled environment on a loose surface track or a skid pad and hold a car sideways. Learn where the slip angle is. Learn how to communicate with your tires so that you know where the edge is. And when you get in trouble, you can pull yourself out of the you know what. And that part of old cars is a great exercise because the tire is small. It's old technology, bias ply. And so the car is just moving all the time. And then you jump back into this very digital experience where you have, like you talked about, the Trans Am car. Big tire, big brakes, driver aids, ABS, traction control.
Yeah.
And now you can almost be one step ahead of the car because you've been sliding around in this 1968 911 the weekend before. I will say, though, that the sensation of speed is much lower in the older cars. So when you jump back in the new stuff, it takes a little bit of adjustment because it's so much quicker. Things are coming at you so much faster.
The aero that we're referring to, sort of the top of the show and the crazy downforce, the story I always tell is, when I got in that race, they said, I don't know, it was a 100-mile race, and they said, you know, after 75 miles, the tires are going to get pretty greasy or whatever, and they're going to start to kind of go away. And so we'd be up at the horseshoe where the Budweiser thing is at Willow Springs, and I started noticing, like, oh, yeah, everyone's sliding around, and you're turning the wheel a lot more, and trying to feather it before you really get back on it, like coming back down. And I was like, boy, these tires are going away. And I was behind a couple of professionals, Tommy Dreese, and who was leading the race, and I was in third or fourth at the time. And these guys were going for turn eight, and they were wide open. And I was like, all I could think of is, like, we're all going off. We're never going to be on this track. What are you guys doing? We're going 160 miles an hour for this turn, and we just got done sliding all over the place. I had no aero thoughts at all. I'd never had a conversation with the team owner or anything. I just went, these guys know what they're doing, so I'll just stay with them. And if they don't lift, I'm not lifting either. And everyone stayed on the track, but it freaked me out for the last 25 laps of the race. And then when I got out of the car, I was like, how come we stay on the track with no tires? He's like, it's all aero, man. And I'm like, yeah, you should have said something before I got in the car. And then the other one they did, which was funny, is they have the old digital dash now, you know? And then I was like, I got out of the car and qualifying or something. I was like, I don't know what gear I'm in. I don't know what the temps are. I don't know what the speed is. I don't know what the RPMs are. And the guy leans in and he goes, oh, you had it in pit mode. I said, I didn't have it in any...
Yeah,
I never.
I
was scared to touch any. I don't want to touch the steering wheel. The guy like flicks it and he goes, "Yeah, that's track mode now. That's RPM stuff." I'm like, okay, somebody put their head in this car next time and figure this out.
You know, you were talking about aero. I had a chance to do a few laps in a Lotus V10 F1 car out at Thermal, very cool. And part of the training was they had these Lotus Evoras, the Evoras with the supercharger, and you're out there doing a bunch of laps and learning the track a little bit. Thermal's very flat, so it's more just you can see everything out there. It's not anything like you said, Atlanta or even Laguna Seca. And, you know, just typical running around the track. You're like, you're hitting the turn. You hear the tire squeal. It's like either less throttle or less steering, right? That's all you can do. They're like, okay, now you did 2 days of learning that. You're getting the F1 car, and when you take the turn, and if you hear the tire squeal, hit the gas more because it's got to go faster to push down. That car is all aero. And he's like, forget everything you just learned. I was like, then why did we do that for 2 days? Why did we just drive those cars for 2 days to do that? But that car just... You mash it down on the straightaway, and it does turn into a cartoon. Everything gets blurry on your sides. You think that's just a movie thing,
right?
But you're like, no, that actually does happen. And your helmet starts to lift off your head because, you know, it's obviously open cockpit. And you're like, why am I choking? You're like, my helmet is pulling off your head. And on the top of that steering wheel, the basically the rev counter, which goes up to, you know, to the shift light, it's just fast. It's just whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. I'm like,
what's the power plant on that car?
It was a V10. I don't know what year.
Probably
maybe 2010 or so. And I think they can make something like 750 horsepower. They detune it a little bit to like 650, and they said just doing that is the difference between like 10 hours and 100 hours of livability basically on that engine. They're like, just bring it down a notch and it's 10 times the life. And I'm like, oh, that's why F1's so expensive.
All right, let me hit Castrol Edge. Stronger under pressure, engines can lose up to 10% of performance due to friction. Castrol Edge with fluid titanium transforms under pressure, keep them metal parts from rubbing and robbing. 3 times stronger.
Three times, fool.
Than leading full synthetic against viscosity breakdown. It's the best. It's Edge. It's Castrol Edge, everybody. All right.
What is the on Canepa 962 versus Williams F1 car? What at Laguna Seca? What kind of time differences are we talking about?
Oh, I don't know lap. I mean, I couldn't tell you what lap times I did last weekend, but I could guess that I think it was Mark Chenet who set the record in an older Ferrari at Laguna Seca, as we call it. I would guess 10 seconds plus.
Wow.
It's quite a big difference. And horsepower-wise, again, back to this weight and horsepower, there was probably more horsepower in the 962, but the weight of a Formula One car and the downforce, those are the unfair advantages, let alone 30 years of development of electronic aids and tire development and brake technology, things like that. But experiential-wise, I would guess completely different, two completely different experiences, both individual and unique and both awesome.
I heard from somebody that 962 is a relatively, I don't mean simple, but an easier car to drive than like a traditional rear-end Porsche. Like it's just better balanced, not as challenging. Is that a true statement?
I would say so. Physically very difficult, but fundamentally to operate the car and the grip and the weight distribution and balance, yes. I mean, 962 is a mid-engine car, single or twin turbo, well, decades ahead of its time. I mean, that's why that car was successful for, you know, 20-plus years, is that Porsche had basically, again, pulled a rabbit out of the hat and engineered a car that basically blew the Group C sort of traditional days wide open. And of course they had great competition from Jag and Nissan and some others, but from a longevity standpoint, that car was well ahead of its time. And yeah, you jump into it fundamentally, as soon as you learn how to shift the car, there's not much to have to do from a digital side. It's a very analog car, and it's probably the best era of racing, in my opinion, would be sort of the late 80s, when it was still analog, very visceral, very emotional, but producing lap times that would hold up against modern GT competition today.
Yeah, Nissan had some pretty killer GTP stuff, and Jag was into it, and it was really the cars, you know, eventually everything's going to be vintage, I tell everyone, and the cars, they hold up, like they look good, you kind of remember them. I remember all the liveries, you know, like the Löwenbräu on a 962 is like an awesome livery. Yeah. Wins is cool. I think the Hotchkiss guys have the Wins car.
Yeah, they have the Wins car. I think.
All right, let me give you guys a plug. What's the next event that you guys are going to? The next race, the next... what's on the calendar?
What do you got going? I think
we're going to go up into the Santa Monica Mountains this winter, because this is the off season for both of us. So it's all about taking our vintage Porsches up into the hills. Patrick doesn't know it yet, but we got that all set up. But no, it's coming up on off season from the racing side. For you guys though, you have WEC coming up.
Yeah, we've got the next race in China is coming up, and then that season's going to go. We go to China, and then we take a break through the holidays, and then we're at Sebring. I'll get into the car a little bit, try to get some testing in. We've been trying to work on that. I'd love to do some sprint races. Really love off-road racing. I mean, really enjoy that too. So just to get in a little bit and balance out the family and work and everything. So
is your racing team going to grow into off-road, you think?
No, I think what our thing is really developing the young drivers. I think Patrick and I really want to find the next young American driver to get to Europe. That's what we're working on, and a couple of those projects. It's like, I mean, Patrick's career to me would be, if I could start over, that would be the career I'd want. I mean, he's. Have you not, what race haven't you done that you want to do?
Pike's
like
Peak?
The Mille Mille or something like that. Yeah. But the modern race, I've been very fortunate to basically check off the boxes from Baja 1000 to NASCAR to V8 supercars, and of course every single sports car race, and so very grateful on that level. But I had some fun with you out here in the desert. We did the Mint 400 a few years ago, and this guy's a madman. We take off, first of all, you're lining up at 3:30 in the morning to start the race, and so the sun hasn't even broken, and it's just pure dust, and this guy's wide open, just hitting tumbleweeds. He passes me on the outside. Later on in the race, the other part of the story is he flips the thing, it lands on the wheels straight to the starter button, and just
it kept going. We kept going. Yeah. That was the thing that couldn't...
So yeah, the off-road stuff is fun, but neither one of our insurance underwriters want to know what we do in the off-road side. Yeah.
How intense is the V8 supercar? I mean, I've seen some of that. I don't know, it's big in Australia and whatever. That racing looks so goddamn fun. That just looks like so much fun. It's like, in a way, it kind of takes the best parts of the road circuit of NASCAR and mixes it in with sports car racing and GT, whatever. But those guys are right on each other. Is that up there for you in terms of just a thrill?
Definitely. An amazing event, an amazing series, but the cars themselves, spec brake pads, spec tires, lots of horsepower, kind of that old school Group C or Trans Am vibe. I mean, imagine that Trans Am car you drove with 800 horsepower, but with 4 inches less tire and no driver aids, and now you have 30 cars with top level drivers and teams. I mean, you have Andretti buying in over there, Penske, all the top teams from the U.S. have bought into this championship, and there's basically cricket and, you know, V8 supercars. That is their pinnacle of motorsports. So you roll into a liquor store on race day weekend and there's cardboard cutouts of these drivers. I mean, it's a really big sport over there. Tabloid, centerfolds, all that type of stuff. So I was way overwhelmed by the whole experience. But the driving side, other than shifting with my left hand, because it was still a sequential box, right-hand drive, and we're on a street track, so you have to run right up to the edge of the track at Surfers Paradise. Other than the coordination with my left hand, the rest was okay.
Boy, that is some of the most exciting racing you'll see on TV.
Yeah, that was. I never got a chance to do that. Bathurst is always the one I regret I never had an opportunity to do. I know it's scary as all hell in the elevation.
It's scary.
It's crazy.
The kangaroos is the wildest part of Bathurst. Is they have like a yellow flag with an animal on it. And that means watch out because Skippy has made it through all of the different barriers they've put up, and the things want to cross the track because you're on the side of a mountain outside of Sydney, and legitimately we think kangaroos are this novel animal. They're rodents to the Aussies, and they're just big rodents that get run over by trucks, and so yeah, they find their way onto the racetrack and it ends the day for the race car.
So well, that's like that Montreal's like that too, with not the kangaroos but with the woodchucks or whatever it was, or the groundhogs running out in front of you all the time.
Well, LA's getting that way with the homeless, like I mean, let's be honest. All right,
it's the race car, people, as you said.
it got the splitter all screwed up on my Dodson. Hurley, people should see, by the way, a great documentary on Hurley Haywood, which I had the opportunity to watch a couple months back when Patrick came in. Patrick, should we just send people to the website, DempseyCenter.org, if they want to know about your charitable organization or check out your Instagram?
Yeah, if you, anybody in your family has been impacted by cancer, we don't treat the disease. We treat the person. We treat the whole person, the family. So if there's any help we can do, we have two centers in Maine. But if you're anywhere in the country and you need some assistance, please call in. We can direct you to, similar like-minded centers in your area if we can. So check it out and certainly support us.
And Patrick Long, patricklong.com, and you can shoot him an Instagram or tweet at PL Motorsport as well. We cover.
When's your next event, Patrick?
Yeah, we also do a little show called Lufgekult, which we're grateful you guys came out and brought your car. That was a lot of fun.
Are you allowed
Thank
to
you
talk
for making
about
it a quarter of a mile away from our shop, by the way? That was fantastic.
That was. I waited to tell you guys how far you had to travel once we had the venue locked down.
Yeah. Do you have any news on 2020? You're looking at venues?
We are fixed on our venue. We're fixed on our date. We haven't announced either, but we're excited to throw another curveball. This will be our 7th year of Lufgekult. We've done a few other events outside of the U.S., Germany. We did Munich and England, but this year's main show will be toward the end of May, and look for some new developments in how it's all going to go down. People think they have us figured out by now. Oh, it's an L.A. show, and it's at the end of April, and I'm going to book my tickets 8 months in advance, and we're blown away. We had 48 of 50 states and 22 countries in attendance at last year's show at Universal Back this year's show that you came to. So it's become sort of this world gathering of crazy air-cooled Porsches. But the whole idea of Luft from when we first kicked it off in 2014 when Patrick came down in his 356 was undoing the stigmas of car shows and creating a happening where even your non-car gearheads in the household want to attend, but still having the best of the best cars and working with partners like AEM, who have the 935 behind us that was there this year. It's a dual objective, but we're still keeping up with the demand.
I tell you, congratulations on that event. I can't think of any event, let alone a car event, that has grown faster and just continues to get bigger and better, and just an amazing
great
event.
Spirit at these
it
events
really is.
And the cars and the people and
They're so well attended. It's so diverse, and there's so many enthusiasts out there, and it's sort of confusing. You'd be like, why would this be so attractive? It's the way it's put on. We had a great time, and we look forward to coming to the next one. We got another Porsche.
Oh yeah, we got Paul Newman's 1974 911S. Which has it's the naturally aspirated engine, but with the RSR bodywork and stuff on it. It's
very cool.
It's,
right.
And
it's
he ran ends. It. Yeah. He drove it at Sebring in '77 with had an Audi Beverly Hills Audi Porsche
Freeman
livery, and Bill Freeman was the guy who did. So
very cool.
Maybe that would be a cool
so two
piece
Porsches
to bring
in
down.
The collection now.
Two Porsches.
Now that livery kicks my nerd senses on, and we need that car this next year. And it'll make more sense later. So let's,
you know where it is.
Just tell me if I need to put some parts in the pickup truck and come up and wrench with you guys. But let's get that thing going for the end of May.
Definitely.
It's good. It's in great shape. I think it runs.
All awesome. Right.
We can drive on that.
Yeah.
That's cool.
We can. Sure. Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you. Good
appreciate
to see you. It's good to
always
talk to you.
Good.
Thanks
always
for having
good.
Us.
Thanks,
always
guys.
Great.
Thank you so
thanks,
much.
Buddy.
Thank
see you.
See you
soon.
Real quick, let me tell you a little bit about Geico, our friends at Geico. We love them over there. Everybody's got a to-do list. You're dropping off your dry cleaning, picking up some milk. Now you can save hundreds of dollars on car insurance to that list, and you don't have to drop off or pick up anything. If you just go to geico.com, and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. So if you want some extra money in your pocket, this is the most rewarding to-do you can do today. Go to geico.com.
All right. Guard Hollinger, we haven't seen you since Europe, right?
Goodwood.
Since Goodwood.
2017, I think.
Yeah.
Guard is Keanu Reeves' partner in building Arch Motorcycles, as featured on Jay Leno's Garage a couple of seasons ago.
Very fortunate.
He does everything that we do first, pretty much. Yeah, yeah. Everything that's on CarCast ends up
he
on Jay Leno's Garage.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
But we like him, and he's very sweet.
You have some mole sending him your schedule.
Yeah, yeah, he's down there. So Arch Motorcycles, I'm so impressed with it. We spoke, like you said, it was a few years ago at Goodwood, and I love what you guys are doing just in the craftsmen, the fabrication, the design, the amount of machining stuff you guys have been doing, and over the years, even since we spoke last, a lot of carbon fiber development is fantastic on the bike.
There's a couple of Arch motorcycles I'm looking at here at the K&N booth, just so we can be clear on this. So there's a connection, but sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and what I was going to say is some of the elements, the split gas tank with I guess the intake sort of hidden inside there makes it so that you don't have to have this air filter hanging off the side where you hit it with your leg and
right.
just some really, really cool design elements. Wanted to
thanks. I was just gonna let you keep going.
Yeah. We don't need you for this. I love the bike, so
thank you. That's really
we
nice.
Just stand there and look at it and we're like, oh, look at the machine work here, look at the machine work here.
Yeah,
and
we're a little everything obsessive fits perfectly. About that kind of stuff. But yeah, what you're talking about is like the induction system being sort of squeezed in the middle of the bike and hidden between the tanks, so you don't have that big thing in your leg, like you typically have on a big V-twin. So
the Arch motorcycles are, we're fans of Singer Porsche, so I would say in a sense that it's a production bike, but it is bespoke. So you go in and you meet with you guys, you say, hey, I want one of your bikes, and then you say, great. Now let's design it and figure out what you want.
Yeah.
And here, it's just, that's the price.
That's precisely what's really unique about it in the motorcycle world is that it is a production motorcycle, but it's designed to be tailored to the customer. So ergonomically, we can shape the seat, we can move the foot controls, hand controls, fine-tune it to them. And then, of course, all the finishes and the livery and the colors and everything is custom to them. So when it's done, it's on a proven platform, but it's unique to them.
Is it good? We love what's going on with Singer and Rod Emery and Jonathan Ward.
Yeah,
you know, we love the idea that you can take these guys. And I've seen the Singer guys a million years ago and Jonathan Ward and all these things. And it seems like such a harebrained scheme, you know.
It is.
I'm going to make this. I'm going to take this Bronco and I'm going to sell it for $250,000, you know. And everyone's like, are you nuts?
You're nuts.
It's never going to work. You know, and I love that the consumer has woken up to this sort of craftsmanship and it's the story. Like, I was talking to Leno about Arch Saturday, and I was saying, you know, a Singer, Arch, you have a story. It's a story. You can go buy a stock Kawasaki that works, you know, but you don't get the story with that.
It's a different story.
It's a different story. I went down to Van Nuys, and there went to the Kawasaki dealer.
I gave them $12,000, and they gave me a motorcycle.
But you guys must be rooting for the Singers and the Jonathan Wards out there of the world, because the resale is going through the roof. It's proven that it works.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Look at what can you buy a Singer under $1 million now?
Well, one sold for like $860 or something. Yeah. A used one.
Yeah, at Gooding, at Gooding or RM, it was at an auction. I don't know how you even get on the list now. And what's interesting is for them, one of the things that they've done is people that bought like a first generation Singer, if that's the right term, they're able to bring it back and sort of get it updated to, so you never really know what year it was made.
Oh, really? Okay.
And what I've noticed with you guys is the KR GT1 was the first bike that you have, but this is the 2019 or 2020 version of it. Has features it didn't have. You guys have ABS brakes on the bike.
Yes.
Now.
I mean, a lot of this was driven by the desire to sort of keep up not only with technology but also regulatory things. And we're really close to having the European type approval so that, you know, a customer in Europe can buy it and easily register it. Their regulations are much more strict than here in the U.S.
Oh, really?
So a lot of it was driven by that. But it's nice to also add some technology and safety, right? I mean, motorcycles aren't safe by nature, but anything you can do to take any anxiety away from the rider is a good thing.
How did the relationship with Keanu start, with you or with Arch, or how did that work?
So somebody introduced me to him at my old shop, and he wanted to have a sissy bar built. And I said, well, I don't really want to build a sissy bar. And so then he saw some motorcycles I was building, and he said, well, what else can we do to my motorcycle? And basically, we threw everything away except the serial numbers on the engine and the chassis and built what ended up being the prototype for the KR GT1. Even before it was done, because it was being built sort of in the virtual world at the same time, he started saying, we should make some more of these and share them with the world. And well, I said, let me just finish this one.
Well, speaking of the world, and you were just talking about getting them certified in Europe and beyond, I'm guessing these things are going to get shipped out all over the place. What is a big market for you guys or for motorcycles that might not be in the United States?
Well, obviously Europe. Right, and then if you have the European type approval, that pretty much gets honored in Asia, Japan, Australia, Canada. So it opens up our market tremendously.
So we mentioned the ABS brakes being, I guess, a requirement to get that approval. What else needs to be done?
There's all kinds of wacky stuff that...
emissions must be something.
Well, emissions are a big one, but there's even, they have this... a whole list of things they call external projections, and it'll just bore you to death, but you have to have a certain amount of clearance for your tires to not touch anything, but not even just a tire, an imaginary envelope created by a formula based on the tire size.
Wow.
That has nothing to do with reality of how a tire grows, and it's just a crazy list, and everything's a formula with some weight of measurement or distance that you're not familiar with.
Is there a waiting list? Is there a backlog? How many of these things can you do in a month? How's that business part of it working?
So we're very, very low volume. Right now we think our capacity is maybe 25 motorcycles a year. Mm-hmm. The waiting list is really just the time it takes to build it. You know, we usually are able to build and deliver the motorcycle within 90 days of completing the sort of the creative process with the customer. Most of that time, honestly, is spent dealing with outside finish processing and doing the quality of that. Mm-hmm. Assembly and testing.
Sure.
We can do in about 2 weeks.
If the power plant is derived from what or what?
So the power plant is made by a company in Wisconsin named S&S Cycle. And it's basically a derivative of a Harley-Davidson engine. So it's
S&S is another brand that's grown huge over the years and got into drag racing motorcycles. And
yeah, and they've been around for over 60 years, and they're really good at what they do. And
the displacement is what?
124 cubic inch, so a little over 2 liters, 2032.
Wow. That's huge.
It does seem huge.
It's
a huge
engine.
So what kind of power do you guys make with that?
So it's mostly a torque factor.
Yeah,
like
the
horsepower
thing,
numbers aren't super impressive, but the torque is, you know, like 100 foot-pounds of torque that happens like from 1,800 RPMs to 2,000 RPMs. So it's like immediately when you twist the throttle.
I had a Honda 404, which is four pistons and 400 cc's.
Yeah.
So you could imagine the size of that piston.
Yeah.
I'll tell you though, that bike handled really well. I love a good handling bike. I always brag to people. They always think I'm lying, but I'm like, what do you think? I'm an asshole. I rode that thing down Coldwater Canyon one night from Mulholland, and I never touched the handlebars.
I just put my hands out.
I put my hands on the tank.
Okay.
I just leaned forward. I worked the foot brake. I kicked it in neutral. I was like, 22 and bored. And I went all the way down Coldwater Canyon from Mulholland. I made it past Ventura Boulevard. I made it past Moore. I got all the way to Moore Park. Like, I made the lights. I was just coasting the whole time, my foot on the brake. It worked. It wasn't even hard to do. Like, I don't know. The guys should have the bikes where they're all laid back and they're ape hangers and everything. I worry about those guys. Like, I would be freaked
Again,
out
it's
with
a
the
different
ape
experience.
It's a different experience. It's a different story to tell. Yeah.
But I just feel like the handling, I mean, the position of the arch stuff looks so great. I just like that position of sort of leaning forward rather than hanging on.
Well, and the KRG T1, obviously, is forward control, so it's a little bit different riding position, but it's not, you're not back on the sofa. You can be active and up and in it. But this is a new motorcycle that we're industrializing now called the 1S, and so it's much more sport oriented. And
is the can you take the price, like, what's the base, and then what could you take it to?
So, for example, a KRG T1, the base price is $85,000. There isn't really a lot you could do to it. Sometimes there's a little bit of an upcharge depending on the complexity of the paint, or I suppose if you wanted an elephant ear seat.
Right.
First of all, we probably won't do that. But, so really, most everything can get covered in that 85K. Like I said, sometimes a slight upcharge for paint. The 1S is going to be at 120, and it'll probably be the same thing. It'll probably be very few things that there will be upcharges for.
Where should people go if they want to check out Arch and look at some of the
stuff? They could go to archmotorcycle.com.
I'm trying to find your plug sheet here. I don't know what. Oh, I'm looking at it. Sorry.
Yeah.
I got too many sheets on me. By the way, to be fair to me, I got up at 5 this morning, got on an airplane. You cut me some slack. Ah, there we go. Yeah. Oh, not that. But go to archmotorcycle.com. Chris, do I have a commercial read or anything like that here? All right. Well, Gard, thanks for coming in, man. It was good to see you again.
You're welcome, and glad to see you guys again.
And congratulations, because the stuff just looks. I talk to Matt about it all the time. I'm like, I love people out making their stuff. I love when you get up on one of those Singers or one of those Jonathan Wards or one of the Arch things. We both are sticklers for the details and the fasteners, and I'm looking at the front brakes and the stars, star-driven nuts on there and everything. It's like, I don't know. I don't know what it takes to appreciate that. I wish more people were into that part
of life.
When
you see the bike, you guys have to see the bike in person if you get a chance, because it is very raw. And it's very functional, and that creates so much beauty in the product. It is, I think, the best-looking bike out
there.
Thank
you. They're very kind.
You guys can see, when you really crawl in and look at the details, just the way everything fits on that thing is fantastic. But congratulations again.
Good. Well, appreciate it. And stay tuned, because actually the reason we're here is we have a partnership with K&N. And so we have some new product development that'll be coming. So,
oh, good.
More stuff, hopefully.
Look forward to that. And give our love to Keanu.
I will do.
And until next time, this is Adam Carolla for Patrick Dempsey and Patrick Long and Gard Hollinger
and
Steve
Williams and
wait, who's it?
And Richard.
Oh, Richard. Bisson. And Richard from the K&N booth at SEMA saying mahalo.
For the latest updates and call-in times, follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CarCast Show. If you'd like to write in, fill out the form on CarCastShow.com. And don't forget to give us a nice rating on iTunes. CarCast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana. For more information, visit CarCastShow.com.
trinity of power. You need all three to bring your engine to life. Kenny and Norm knew that, which is why for over 50 years, the company that bears their name has been re-engineering what filtration can do. Engineered to protect against dirt and scientifically proven to provide up to 50% more airflow. K&N, 50 years of performance and innovation.